I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Israel and Russia talk Syria diplomacy. Syrian refugees reportedly being attacked in Turkey.
This is certainly an area of concern, and the government must find ways of managing this social tension.
Growing concern about the security of suspected chemical weapons stockpiles in Syria. And incorporating Islamic musical influences in flamenco. It's all ahead. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed the Syria crisis today, as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced in Stockholm that he expects a proposed Syria peace conference backed by Washington and Moscow to be held in early June. Jessica Golaher has details from Moscow.
Mr. Putin welcomed Mr. Netanyahu in the Black Sea Resort town of Sochi, the venue for the 2014 Winter Olympics. After the meeting, the Russian leader said the two discussed how to resolve the crisis in Syria.
Разумеется, мы очень много говорили сегодня о проблемах региональной безопасности. Особую тревогу вызывает ситуация в Сирии.
Mr. Putin says that he and Mr. Netanyahu have a common understanding that if the armed conflict in Syria persists, it can have disastrous consequences for both Syria and the region. He adds that in this crucial period, it is extremely important to avoid any actions that could aggravate the situation. Mr. Netanyahu said he's glad he got the chance to discuss the conflict with Russia's president. The Israeli leader says he had a very detailed and deep conversation over the state of the region. Mr. Netanyahu says that Israel and Russia are trying to find a way to strengthen stability and security in the Middle East. The Kremlin has expressed concern over alleged recent Israeli airstrikes on targets near Damascus. Israel has yet to comment on the issue, but analysts say that the targets in Syria were weapons deliveries to Hezbollah militants based in Lebanon. Israel is worried about Kremlin arms supplied to the Syrian government. Mr. Putin has consistently maintained that Moscow isn't breaking any international laws and that it isn't selling anything to Damascus that can be used in a civil conflict. Russia is considered to have a central role when it comes to resolving Syria's bloody civil war. Moscow has refused to back several rounds of sanctions against its Middle Eastern ally, maintaining that it is not the job of the United Nations Security Council to force the ouster of any government. Last week, Mr. Putin met U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to discuss the conflict. Mr. Putin agreed to try to set up talks between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government and the opposition as early as this month. On Tuesday, Kerry said the timing of a peace meeting is up to the United Nations, but that he expected it would take place in early June, although the location has not been confirmed. Jordanian officials said Western and Arab nations opposing Mr. Assad will hold a Friends of Syria meeting in Amman next week to discuss the process. Syrian Information Minister Amran al-Zawoubi said earlier in the day that Damascus wanted specifics on such a conference before it decides whether to be part of it. Mr. Putin met with British Prime Minister David Cameron last week to discuss Syria. Mr. Cameron met with U.S. President Barack Obama on Monday. Jessica Gallagher for VOA News, Moscow.
VOA's Michael Lippin spoke about bringing a transition in Syria with Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
I think that there is now increased interest in trying to come up with some sort of language that would allow for some kind of negotiated settlement. The problem is, though, is what a transition means. And a transition, of course, means, you know, transiting from one authority to another. And until now, we have not had agreement on that. The United States wants Assad to step aside. It is unclear from the Russian side whether that will be required as a result of this, or if Assad would be able to stay on. I can tell you from those of us that look at this every day, it's still far from clear.
We asked why the West and Russia want to negotiate a deal now.
I think because everyone knows that the Syrian state itself is going to melt down, and is already melted down. And putting that back together is going to be very costly, perhaps much more costly than what military intervention would have meant, particularly at an earlier stage. And that's going to be a burden that the United States is going to have to share with many of its allies. So I'm not surprised at this point that we have different parties pursuing their interests through multiple means, given the scale of the problem in Syria.
Why would Syrian President Bashar al-Assad want to join negotiations?
I think that the Assad regime has an opportunity there from its own standpoint, that if it came to the negotiating table and something that was ambiguous, it could split the opposition. You could have those with the opposition going to talk to them. It would also, you know, really, would really depend on how it functioned politically. But really, we just don't know at this point.
What would motivate the rebels to join a political process?
It would be to expose the fact that the Assad regime is not interested in a transition in the way that the rest of the world believes it is, and that its position is quite rigid, that it itself is very rigid, and that the chances of President Assad participating in this, would be less than zero. And I think that it is, but can the opposition play it that way? That's unclear.
Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The twin car bombing Saturday in the town of Rihanli near Turkey's border with Syria killed 48 people and injured more than 100. It also has increased fears that Turkey is being dragged into serious civil war. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul. The Turkish government is facing growing criticism for its support of the Syrian opposition.
Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has emerged as one of the most vocal leaders in the region, supporting the uprising against Syria's Bashar al-Assad. But when the violence crossed over into Turkish soil, with the past weekend's bombing, public criticism of the Turkish government's involvement in the conflict next door became more vocal. Cengiz Aktar, a political scientist at Istanbul's Bahçeşehir University, says the bombings have increased public concern over the government's policy of supporting the Syrian rebels.
No such bombing has ever happened in the soil of this country before. And many people see this as an indirect consequence of Turkey's Syria policy. I think what worries people is that Turkey may be dragged in the conflict, and people are afraid that similar bombings may happen anywhere now in the country.
Following Saturday's bombing in Rehanla, protests against the government were held in the Turkish border town of Antakya and the capital, Ankara. And on Monday, the people of Rehanla protested against the government. Stung by the growing criticism, Prime Minister Erdogan defended his policy, warning the bombers' intention was to sow division.
Bu saldırıların amacı en başta milletimin fertleri arasında.
The purpose of these attacks, he said, was to create animosity and disorder inside Turkey and place question marks in the minds of my people. Observers say it's unlikely Turkey's government will change its policy of supporting the Syrian opposition, but public concern over the policy may restrict the government's options for retaliating against Damascus, says Sinan Ülgen, head of the Istanbul-based research institute, İDAM.
I don't think that there is public support at all in Turkey towards a direct military confrontation with Syria. But when a bomb had exploded at the Turkish-Syrian border, the reaction on the Turkish side had been to send Turkish special op teams to go after the perpetrators of that attack, and those people were brought back to Turkey.
When Syrian refugees first entered Turkey in 2011, they were largely well received. But attitudes have since soured. In the aftermath of the Rehanla attack, Syrian refugees in Turkey were reportedly attacked, along with their cars and homes. Analyst Ülgen says the violence indicates a worrying trend.
What we have seen after the terrorist attacks is the attack against Syrian refugees, which was held under control. But nonetheless, there is a clear sign of tension in the provinces where those Syrian refugees are. Between the local population and the Syrian refugees. So I think this is certainly an area of concern, and the government must find ways of managing this social tension.
Observers warn that with Syrian refugees streaming over the border, tensions between refugees and local Turks are likely to grow. Meanwhile, Ankara has urged other nations to act against the Assad government. On Monday, US President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron reaffirmed their determination to achieve a negotiated solution to end Syria's civil war through a hopeful peace conference. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
As fighting continues between Syrian government troops and opposition forces, there are growing concerns about the security of suspected chemical weapons stockpiles. In this report from Washington, VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshner looks at what is known about Syria's chemical weapons production and storage facilities.
Syria is said to have one of the world's largest chemical weapons arsenals, including mustard gas, the nerve agent sarin, and VX, the most toxic of all chemical agents. Syria also has the military hardware to deliver chemical weapons, such as ballistic missiles, artillery rockets and shells, as well as bombs dropped from airplanes. But experts say there is very little hard data on Syria's chemical weapons program. Syria decided not to be party to the Chemical Weapons Convention that outlaws the production, possession, and use of such weapons. Most of the stockpile estimates come from intelligence agencies and analysts. They believe Syria's chemical weapons are produced in 4 or 5 facilities and stored in dozens of places throughout the country. Greg Thielman, an analyst with the Arms Control Association, a private research firm, says the U.S. intelligence community has a pretty good idea of where some of the chemical weapons stockpiles are. But he also issues a warning.
One recalls how definitively Donald Rumsfeld said we knew exactly where Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons were, and of course he didn't have any at that point. So I'm sure we don't know all the locations. I'm sure we know some of them, but they are multiple. And I know that Western intelligence services are trying to keep an eye on the ones we know.
Thielman says that while there is a chance that these weapons could fall into the hands of militant groups such as Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda, that threat so far appears to be in check.
One of the silver linings to the dark cloud over Syria at the moment is that, as far as we know, these large stockpiles of chemical weapons are still securely in the hands of the Assad regime, which means that at least right now there's not a high danger of the chemical weapon stockpiles being disseminated to non-governmental terrorist groups.
There has been some discussion about what to do to secure the Syrian chemical weapons arsenal if the crisis escalates. The U.S. Defense Department estimates it would take 75,000 American forces to properly secure the stockpiles. John Pike is head of globalsecurity.org, a firm specializing in defense issues.
Obviously, sending in Western troops to secure stockpiles in Syria, it would be a real challenge for the Syrians who spent a long time developing that capability, and they aren't just going to turn it over as soon as the Americans show up. So you would have to fight your way through the Syrian army in order to get to it.
Some have called for Western nations to bomb suspected Syrian chemical weapons sites. But that idea is rejected by Greg Thielman of the Arms Control Association.
Sometimes I read about, well, we should attack some of the chemical weapons facilities. I think that's a very reckless charge. I mean, any kind of kinetic action against the facilities would likely spread agent to innocent civilians, and it's just a very reckless charge. And in light of the enormous costs of the Iraq war in terms of lost opportunities, American deaths, Iraqi deaths, maimed Americans, budget deficits. How can people make these suggestions so casually? It baffles me.
Analysts reflect Western fears that if rebels, combined with militant or Islamist forces, continue to gain control in more areas of the country, Syria's chemical stockpile will be vulnerable. Depending on who gets their hands on chemical weapons and what they do with them, analysts warn what happens next is anybody's guess. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Robert Mardini with the International Committee of the Red Cross says his organization cannot confirm nor deny that the Assad government has used chemical weapons against its own citizens.
If our delegates are confronted in a situation where there is use of chemical weapons, we will raise it with the authorities or with the parties or with the armed opposition group according to who has been allegedly using these weapons. But we don't do investigations.
Earlier this month, Turkey's foreign minister said Syrian casualties being treated in Turkey had shown signs of chemical weapons attacks. The U.S. says it wants conclusive proof that chemical weapons have been used before taking any action in Syria. The Assad government has denied using the weapons, which are banned by international law. Meanwhile, Mardini says the conflict in Syria has become a major catastrophe because it impacts neighboring countries. The ICRC head of operations for the Near and Middle East said in Geneva Monday, the conflict is creating huge needs for humanitarian assistance.
More than 2 years after the beginning of the crisis, the conflict and its impact on neighboring countries has developed into a major catastrophe. There is no political solution on the horizon. There is also a widening gap between needs of ordinary Syrians trying to survive and the overall humanitarian response on the ground. In other words, we are facing an exceptional level of humanitarian needs.
The ICRC is asking donors for more than $65 million to help with the humanitarian crisis in Syria. The first of an estimated 2,000 Kurdish militants withdrawing from Turkey have arrived in Iraq as part of a peace process aimed at ending 30 years of conflict. The group of at least 13 men and women from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, crossed into the Harar area of northern Iraq early today. The militants began leaving their bases in Turkey last week, with the full withdrawal expected to take 3 to 4 months. Bulent Alireza is the director and senior associate at the Turkey Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We asked him what the withdrawal means for Turkey.
Well, clearly it's an important development because Turkey has been engaged in a conflict with the PKK, the Kurdish terrorist organization, which began its operations back in 1984. And if the withdrawal was to lead the way to a resolution of the problem, it would be very significant for Turkey, which has suffered the loss of thousands of lives over the past 30 years and also incurred tremendous financial costs because of this conflict.
What does it mean for the future of the PKK? Is it going to disappear?
Well, the statements from the imprisoned leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, as well as his lieutenants, who are actually based in northern Iraq and are directing the withdrawal from Turkey, they obviously want additional steps, reciprocal steps from Turkey. The prime minister said that there has not been any kind of bargaining between Turkey and the PKK, but nonetheless, they do expect that there is going to be some kind of amnesty for of those who were involved in PKK violence against Turkey, and perhaps even the release to house arrest of Öcalan. So maybe we will see, if all these were to happen, the PKK transforming itself into a semi-political organization, similar to the IRA in Ireland, but we're far from there.
Now, the members of this group are moving into Iraq, so it will affect Iraq, but will this withdrawal affect the region as well?
Yes, I think the vision that the Turkish Prime Minister has is a resolution of the Kurdish problem within Turkey, beginning with the elimination of the PKK, signified by the withdrawal today, and the establishment of a relationship with the Kurds beyond Turkey, particularly in northern Iraq, and also in Syria, which will lead to a Turkish-Kurdish alliance, as it were, which will certainly affect the regional balance. And the countries that would be most affected by this, obviously, are Iran, Syria, and the central government in Iraq.
Bulent Alireza, director and senior associate at the Turkey Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. U.S. President Barack Obama, at his joint news conference with British Prime Minister David Cameron Monday, faced more questioning about September's attack in Libya that killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens and 3 other Americans. The president was asked about disclosures that talking points about the attack produced by the intelligence community were later changed to delete references to Islamic militants. Republicans insist that the Obama administration misled Congress and the American people in the immediate aftermath of the attack, trying to play down an act of terrorism that would reflect poorly on Mr. Obama ahead of the November election. Mr. Obama called opposition Republican criticism of the handling of the Benghazi attack a political sideshow.
Americans died in Benghazi. What we also know is clearly they were not in a position where they were adequately protected. The day after it happened, I acknowledged that this was an act of terrorism. And what I pledged to the American people was that we would find out what happened, we would make sure that it did not happen again, and we would make sure that we held accountable those who had perpetrated this terrible crime. That's exactly what we've been trying to do. And over the last several months, there was a review board headed by two distinguished Americans, Mike Mullen and Tom Pickering, who investigated every element of this. And what they discovered was some pretty harsh judgments in terms of how we had worked to protect consulates and embassies around the world. They gave us a whole series of recommendations. Those recommendations are being implemented as we speak. The whole issue of this, of talking points, frankly, throughout this process has been a sideshow. What we have been very clear about throughout was that immediately after this event happened, we were not clear who exactly had carried it out, how it had occurred, what the motivations were. It happened at the same time as we had seen attacks on U.S. embassies in Cairo as a consequence of this film. And nobody understood exactly what was taking place during the course of those first few days. The emails that you allude to were provided by us to congressional committees. They reviewed them several months ago, concluded that, in fact, there was nothing afoul in terms of the process that we had used. And suddenly, 3 days ago, this gets spun up as if there's something new to the story. There's no there there. Keep in mind, by the way, these so-called talking points that were prepared for Susan Rice 5-6 days after the event occurred pretty much matched the assessments that I was receiving at that time in my presidential daily briefing. And keep in mind that 2 to 3 days after Susan Rice appeared on the Sunday shows using these talking points, which have been the source of all this controversy, I sent up the head of our National Counterterrorism Center, Matt Olson, up to Capitol Hill and specifically said it was an act of terrorism and that extremist elements inside of Libya had been involved in it. So if this was some effort on our part to try to downplay what had happened or tamp it down, that would be a pretty odd thing that 3 days later we end up putting out all the information that, in fact, has now served as the basis for everybody recognizing that this was a terrorist attack and that it may have included elements that were planned by extremists inside of Libya. Who executes some sort of cover-up or effort to tamp things down for 3 days? So the whole thing defies logic. And the fact that this keeps on getting churned out, frankly, has a lot to do with political motivations.
President Obama at a Monday news conference at the White House. In a nation of immigrants with a melting pot culture, it should not be surprising that American music is also an international blend. Lonnie Shavelson reports that it's especially true of flamenco, brought to southern Spain by 18th century Romanis and gypsies from North India, and performed today by a California band that incorporates Arabic and other Islamic influences from Turkey, the Black Sea, Persia, and North Africa.
The unmistakable sound of flamenco, Spanish guitar and heels, is transformed by the members of the San Francisco band, La Rulla. One of the band's founding members is Sam Foster. He's a rock and jazz drummer who became fascinated with Arabic and Turkish percussion, and from there to flamenco. He brought in flamenco dancer and choreographer Melissa Cruz and other musicians to create La Rulla's unique sound.
We are taking forms and, in some cases, actual songs from other parts of the world and flamencoizing them so that you have something new, a sound I hadn't heard before. We have oud, which is the Middle Eastern lute. We have a flute player. The cajon, the box drum, and darbuka, which is the gourd drum, also known as doombek.
And, says Melissa Cruz, they have the palmas.
Palmas are flamenco hand claps. And typically, it is the flamenco singer and the flamenco dancer who are doing the palmas.
For VOA News in San Francisco, I'm Lonnie Shavelson.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.